Hello and welcome back to the Weekend Blog. Our good friend Matt Lewis is taking a well-deserved week off. I'm Bill Scheer from Campaign for America's Future and LiberalOasis.com. With me, instead of Matt Lewis, is the great Peter Suderman. Thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
For those who are not familiar with your work, why don't you introduce yourself to the Blogging Heads fans out there.
I am an associate editor at Reason Magazine, Reason.com, contributor to Hit and Run, and an occasional contributor to TheAmericanScene.com.
Are you planning your next career steps to be to leave Reason, join a liberal website, and then become embroiled in a scandal involving your incendiary emails?
It's not in the works yet, but you'll be the first to know if it ever is.
That not everyone at Reason has that career strategy.
I promise you the scoop if it ever happens.
Okay. Now, you had a post up in recent days about the end game of financial reform and the role that my great Senator Scott Brown is impacting on the process. What did you have to say?
Well, basically, what I'm looking at here is that a lot of this is an issue that actually does not break down. Maybe I shouldn't say doesn't break down. The policy part of this debate, of the financial regulation debate, has not been nearly as important as it was in, say, the healthcare debate, where people argued a lot about the actual policies. Instead, what you have are a lot of Democrats talking about how we need to do something about the big bad bankers, and a lot of Republicans talking about how Democrats are wrong. And for populist centrist Republicans, like Scott Brown, like Susan Collins, like Olympia Snowe, who kind of who want to be, on the one hand, sort of relatively good team players, but also want to maintain this reputation for sort of being populist thinkers who aren't you know, just sort of just free market, you know, just conservative stalwarts, and you know, and they're for the people, whatever. That puts them in a really hard position, and so folks like Brown and Snow and Collins, are now holding up the debate, holding up the bill. It's not clear whether they're going to go with this or not. Brown actually basically forced Democrats to go back on the bill and remove a bank tax that they had put in at more or less the last moment, saying he was going to be, you know, okay, I support financial reform, but I don't support any new taxes. What they ended up doing, as I understand, is they ended up replacing that bank tax, the revenue it was supposed to bring in, with TARP money. And so this is actually kind of interesting. And Dan Indiviglio at The Atlantic wrote about this, I think very interestingly and very compellingly. And what he argued is that rather now, instead of a bank tax with banks funding providing this funding,
this is the biggest banks. It wasn't every single bank.
Instead of the large banks providing the funding for this, what we're going to have is the TARP funding, and so which effectively means that all taxpayers, because TARP funding was supposed to go towards reducing the deficit, so now rather than going to reducing the deficit, it's going to go to pay for what the bank tax was going to pay for. It's going to go to pay for financial regulation. And so they've spread that cost out now amongst everyone. And so what Scott Brown did was basically stand up for the right for all of us to pay for helping out the banks here, rather than the banks pay for it themselves.
And I take it from your headline, your headline of your post was reasonable Republican centrists aren't quite sure where the reasonable center is. I take it you're saying there's no coherent principle being employed here.
Certainly for the Republicans who are maybe votes on this, they don't seem to have a very clear line on why they want to vote, why they do or don't want to vote for something, or at least this bill, what they actually think, what it is that they like or don't like about it. I think what they like is the idea of being seen to do something about Wall Street. And what they don't like is the idea that they could be pegged with supporting a tax hike, a new tax. And that's the fact that Wall Street regulation and something as complicated and as sort of incredibly involved as Wall Street regulation has boiled down to that is I think really depressing and kind of telling about, you know, sort of how centrist politics, you know, centrist Republicans think and what, you know, and how that works.
Well, that view of yours shared from some others, I think both in on the left and in other traditional media online sites. Tim Fernholz at the American Prospect, he blogged, at the end of the day, this stripping of the bank tax will have little effect on the mechanics of financial regulation, but it is a loss for good policy. Scott Brown has demonstrated his ability to squeeze the legislative process for what he can get. He's a Bay State Ben Nelson now, but I wonder if his constituents will reward him for what he got. Loopholes for bank-operated hedge funds and the elimination of a bank tax. Assuming this satisfies Brown and his cohort of Republican swing votes, we expect the bill to move forward again. That's basically, he's questioning whether this is really smart politics from the end of the day. Brian Goldsmith also did The Atlantic. I don't think he comes from an ideological viewpoint, but did headline his post, Scott Brown's Strange Populism. There was some buzz earlier in the week that Scott Brown's poll numbers are higher than anybody else in Massachusetts. Being in Massachusetts, I can tell you there hasn't been a lot of coverage about the position Scott Brown is taking, so I wonder if things like this might start putting some dents into his honeymoon.
Well, you had the same thing with Scott Brown and healthcare reform, where you know he came in and he opposed the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. He posed this thing while supporting the Massachusetts healthcare system and saying that he wanted to expand coverage, but just not at this cost or not at – it wasn't really clear what sort of health reform he supported. And actually what this struck me as was sort of a less the move here on financial reform that Scott Brown did struck me as a perhaps less clever Lieberman maneuver, in which one guy sort of realizes, okay, the vote, he may or may not, he's at least one of the last couple and perhaps the last person to sign on, and he can stop it if he wants to, and comes in and demands whatever, in large part just to make his power known. The difference, I think, between Lieberman and Collins and Snow and some of these other sort of centrist types who, you know, like to hold up legislation is that I'm never quite sure if they have a plan, if they know what they're doing, if they want something, if they're doing this for a constituency, if they're doing this for a smart reason. Whereas with Scott Brown, it's seemed pretty clear to me the whole time that he's not doing this for any particular for a smart or, you know, coherent reason, that he's doing it because he can, because he doesn't really know what he thinks about a lot of things, and because this is convenient, and right, and he wants to, and that's where he is successful, is by getting in the middle of things and being the guy who's in the middle and can say, no, I'm not going to do that unless you X, and then, well, I guess he's going to take credit for this.
Well, this is different, I think, than healthcare. Healthcare, I thought he was making a lot of incoherent arguments to make excuses for not voting for the bill at all. There was never a sense he was in play on healthcare, but he's put himself in play on unemployment insurance. He voted for some of the extensions, although not the most recent one. He did vote for one version of financial reform. He got what he wanted in this deal, and now he's being squirrely whether he's going to follow through. But you at least get a sense of, like, you could get his vote. It actually is a possibility. And he's right. Really being a tease on a carbon cap, even though he voted for a carbon cap in the state legislature in Massachusetts. He ran very hard against it when he ran for Senate, and now he's playing the suitor, so who knows? But it is, I think, akin to Collins, Snow, Nelson on the Democratic side, Lieberman. Put me in the deal. Put me in the middle. I may not make any sense. I may not have any logical, coherent thoughts on the subject, but gosh darn, you're going to go through me.
Yeah, and I would say there are good reasons to oppose the bank tax, or at least be skeptical of how the bank tax was structured. John Carney at CNBC wrote a very good post sort of arguing that the way the bank tax was set up was that it gave regulators a lot of political power to decide how they were going to treat banks based on bank practices, which effectively would mean that regulators got to approve a whole lot of bank practices and be nice to the ones that they liked that were serving this community or that community, serving this constituency or that constituency. And so what it would end up doing was giving regulators a lot of power to shape bank practices. It did seem like a very sort of politicized tax, and there were a lot of reasons to oppose it, but I'm not sure any of those reasons I in fact have no confidence that any of those reasons mattered to Scott Brown, and that what he wanted, it seems to me, was, as you say, to be put in the middle of the deal.
Right, which I don't know fits with the I'm going to be a fresh face in Washington rubric he was going for, but yeah, well, I'll let my other Bay State voters decree that in 2012. The other interesting financial reform development within the blogosphere, I think, is this somewhat mild rift on the left whether or not this bill is good enough. And, you know, for the most part, progressive organizations have been supportive of the bill. You know, almost every Democrat is going to vote for it. But Russ Feingold did not vote for the earlier version in the Senate and made very clear he won't vote for the final version. And it's because of his you know, strident position on the subject is one of the reasons why. I mean, we would have to get at least one Republican no matter what, but he's got to get a handful now because of Feingold and maybe because of Maria Cantwell, another senator from Washington State, who did not vote for the earlier version. Feingold took to the Huffington Post to spell out his reasoning, where he basically said, since amendments to curtail the size of banks were defeated or prevented from coming up to a vote earlier, that this would definitively not prevent another crisis from happening, and therefore there's nothing in it worth salvaging. And that prompted a response from also Tim Fernholz, who does a lot of the financial reform blogging at American Prospect, said, I respect Feingold's arguments about critical reforms and won't make it in the bill. It is far from the progressive ideal. I disagree with his argument that this bill isn't worth passing. It represents a victory for Wall Street. It contains a passel of key reforms, many of them underestimated, that make our financial system much safer and cost Wall Street banks billions in lost profit. Legislation is worth passing simply for the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has the power to improve the living standards of citizens across the country, especially the working poor. Even so, Feingold has the right to oppose the bill. He doesn't have the right to obstruct it. I mean, what Feingold is saying is not that he's going to vote no, that he's going to vote to filibuster the bill. And you know, I think others, I think Kevin Drum, among others, have also criticized him on this point, that he's actively planning to filibuster it. One of my colleagues at Campaign for America's Future, Zach Carter, blogging at ourfuture.org, essentially said, I agree with Feingold and all his criticisms. I disagree with Tim Fernholz that this bill is as strong as he makes it out to be, but there is something here worth salvaging, and it's not worth filibustering. It should still pass. And then after it passes, let's listen to Feingold and build on what he is saying and fight on. On the right or in the libertarian blogosphere, is there any sense that there is good in this bill to salvage? You know, there are folks there that railed against the bailouts, that we shouldn't be using government power to help Wall Street. Is anyone looking at this as a way to crack down on Wall Street?
No, I don't think there's much support on the right for this bill at all. And, you know, but I did think that it was interesting seeing some of the split on the left and the way that shook out. Again, it actually reminded me of healthcare reform and the way you saw a group on the left split off and oppose the bill for a little while towards, I think it was, you know, in late February, early March, before the bill passed. You had this this group on the left who were arguing that basically the whole thing was a bailout for, you know, insurance company, for private insurers, and was gonna help them. And you had this momentary thing where there was like a coalition between the right and the left, you know, or parts of the left to oppose the bill. And again, you're seeing this, you know, sort of on the left. You've got, on the one hand, we want to do the most important thing is to have a legislative victory and to pass something that shows that we're doing something about Wall Street. On the other hand, you've got folks who don't see that this bill is going to do a whole lot and don't really think of it as a particularly effective piece of legislation, but more mostly it's effective because it shows that you're doing something. And again, this goes back to what I was saying earlier, which is that it has struck me that for the longest time with this debate, there has not been a whole lot of policy substance involved. Instead, it's been Democrats are against Wall Street and Republicans are against Democrats.
Well, certainly, I think the rhetoric that maybe the average voter actually gets to hear probably stays at that level. I mean, I think there's definitely policy in the bill. It's not a
I don't want to say that there's nothing in the bill. But the public debate, yeah. even you know even by the standards of Washington, where public debate gets watered down and the policy specifics tend to get lost, the public debate about this bill has been surprisingly policy free. And I think actually, you know, Kevin Drum made a similar point maybe a month or so back about how there were a couple of folks on the left writing about the policy here, and that the right kind of didn't touch it, which is not entirely true, but there's a bit of truth to it. The right has focused on a few provisions rather than doing a whole lot of analysis of the bill as a whole. And because of this, we just sort of have this thing where if you want to do something about Wall Street, if you are upset about the financial meltdown, then you want to pass this. And that is the argument that I keep hearing over and over again, and that I feel like is by far the most prominent argument. Rather than okay, what are we going to do specifically to prevent things from, you know, bad things from happening again? And will this bill do that? There's been very little discussion of those questions.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily from lack of effort among the parts of some. I mean, there's been lots of blogging, you know, led very much by Simon Johnson at Baseline Scenario. Certainly the folks that I work with at the campaign, Zach and Richard Eskow, Rorty Baum, Felix Salmon at Reuters. There are lots of talk about what should we do on the derivatives piece? What should we do on the Volcker Rule? What should we do on Consumer Financial Protection Agency? Huffington Post gave a lot of oxygen to a lot of these arguments, and you even saw some bloggers try to get even deeper, you know, stop the Carper Amendment and that sort of thing. But you know, almost every issue that gets talked about in Washington has a certain degree of complexity to it that's hard to simplify for broader consumption. Wall Street reform has got to be probably the most complicated thing that's come down the pike, maybe with the exception of cap and trade, and all the attempts. So what's sort of fascinating to me is, you know, there really wasn't great success in simplifying these concepts for the broader public and really generating, you know, mass online campaigns to, you know, get into the nitty gritty of the bill. Yet because of what you mentioned, the overarching frame, you know, are you with Wall Street or against Wall Street? That was enough to scare Congress. This is the only bill we've seen in the last year and a half that got stronger from a progressive standpoint. In the Senate. The Senate is usually where bills die or get watered down on behalf of corporate interests, and the opposite thing happened here because the general fear of being seen as in the pocket of Wall Street, particularly those, I think, that voted for the bailouts in the first place, was enough to fuel the bill and put more teeth in it as it went along, even though it was next to impossible to actually explain what was going on in detail because what's going on is so complicated.
Right. Well, maybe that's why the explanations, you know, that sort of I was hoping to see and didn't materialize is because they weren't necessary, because the simple message was enough.
I think in this case it was. Should we shift to the other big issue that happened this week, the Elena Kagan hearings?
Yep.
So I didn't say this at any forum, so maybe I don't deserve to pat myself on the back, but I presume this was going to be a snore fest. That she was going to sail through. This was everything was doing. All the bloviating was strictly for show and do pander to various bases. I think that's borne out. But you did see on the left people picking up on a theme from conservative senators. People not happy that Elena Kagan used to clerk for Thurgood Marshall. Atrios at Eschaton had his. Sarcastic headline, Thurgood Marshall, history's greatest monster, gone. But since they obviously aren't planning to derail Kagan, the GOP's coordinated trashing of Thurgood Marshall is just some catnip for their base. And Brian Buettler at Talking Points Memo tried to press the issue with his own interviews with Republican senators. They had been equating Thurgood Marshall with judicial activism, but weren't really interested in explaining what opinions he wrote or supported that were examples of that activism. Presumably they're referring to things like civil rights cases, but they weren't really comfortable saying that publicly. I wonder from your vantage point, were folks on the right happy that Thurgood Marshall is being brought up in this context, or there's some younger conservatives that were kind of cringing and saying, geez, guys, let's move on past this?
Well, I think certainly there were some congressmen who were happy that it was being brought up. I mean, just they chose to. That was their strategy. I'm not sure I entirely understand it. I'm not sure that that public knowledge of Supreme Court history is strong enough for Thurgood Marshall to be a particularly strong talking point. But for whatever reason, it got brought into the debates, and probably because they were hoping it was a way of getting her to expose herself, which is, I think, sort of the thing that everybody was sort of wondering, is it gonna? I mean, are we finally going to get an interesting Supreme Court hearing in which the nominee actually says something and does not simply, tap dance around questions for a couple of days? Obviously, the answer was no. I don't think
were conservatives really upset about that dynamic in the Roberts and Alito hearings?
I think probably less so. Because they were candidates they liked, and this is how, that's how this sort of thing works. Is everybody's sort of intrigued by this, but in the long run, you recognize, okay, you've got a candidate you like, a nominee you like, and this is what's necessary to get by. I mean, that's what happened. That's clearly what happened with Kagan, who wrote a very long and bracing essay about, sort of the awfulness of these charades, and how nobody says anything and it's not helpful, and people should, and nominees should be willing to, state their views more forthrightly. And then, as my colleague Jacob Sullum pointed out, she totally backtracked on this. She basically said,
Post at Reason.com.
On Hit and Run, he noted, pulled out some selections from this essay of hers in which she talked about, sort of the silliness of, saying, well, I can't consider a specific case because it might come up, come up in front of me. But on the other hand, I can't tell you how I would rule unless I had a specific. So in other words, everybody knows the dance at this point, and this is how you get away with saying absolutely nothing. And she wrote a long and bracing essay making fun of this, and not just describing the pattern, but very much criticizing it. And then when questioned about this essay, said, well, that was then and this is now, and I don't think it's absolutely necessary
She went as far as that. She said she was wrong.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, not say you have to think that she's being on the level, but she went as far as saying, I renounce what I wrote in the past.
And I am not sure whether or not to believe that she actually thinks she's wrong, but certainly she thinks that it's necessary to play this game, and it's been impressed upon her, I think rightly so, that this is a necessary game that you have to play. I'm a little, as always, a little frustrated that this game, that this game is the one that is required of Supreme Court justices. But look, it benefits both sides, right? I mean, because it gets Democratic nominees through, and it gets the Republican nominees through. So where is the incentive to get rid of this? Because now everyone knows that as long as you have somebody whose record is clean enough and whose temperament is mild enough, you can get them through.
And I blog at the time of the Roberts hearing, and I think I martyred myself on this point with Matt a few weeks ago. I'll do it again. When Roberts was nominated, and there was a great spin job around him, this is the most brilliant guy who's ever graced our great earth. How could anyone in their right mind oppose this most brilliant legal scholar? And most of the left of the Democratic Party, took a pass on it, said we can't beat this guy. And I was pounding my fist on my keyboard and on Air America Radio saying, you have to set a standard that for a lifetime appointment, just a nice resume is not enough. We need to have some actual evidence of your constitutional approach. And that call was not heeded. In fact, the exact opposite standard was applied, that a nice resume is good enough. And that was applied with Alito, and it was applied to Sonia Sotomayor, and it would be applied to Elena Kagan. So I had a little back and forth with Glenn Greenwald. Glenn Greenwald is someone on the left who has been complaining about Kagan and saying we need to know more about where she is before she is nominated. We shouldn't go on Obama's word and just trust that she's going to be good on the issues that we care about. And my point has been, I agree with that, but I'm not going to selectively apply that standard to one party's nominees. Either you apply it to everybody or you don't apply it at all. So for Kagan is basically saying, I'm not going to fall on my sword when this standard is not being applied to the most recent nominees we've had from the right.
And, you know, it's interesting that she, while writing that essay, you know, still managed to conduct her career in such a way that, I mean, you know, you wonder how far back she was planning on this possibility, because clearly she's been thinking about it, you know, at least in the back of her mind, maybe not, you know, with every move she makes every single day, but thinking about the possibility. At some point I might have to answer for all this stuff. You know, the Supreme Court is sort of a place where I could end up going. And so even though, I mean, that essay is probably the most damning, you know, controversial thing that the exception of the abortion language change that's come out. And so she's been, you know, despite writing that, working at keeping her own record clean, which I think says something about her and, you know, sort of her what she's driven to do and how she, you know, and how she might, on the one hand, think this whole thing is sort of silly, but understand even, you know, even before, it seems to me that she understood that that it was going to be necessary if this was what she wanted to do.
And I go as far as to say the folks on the right, maybe they didn't do this because it would be hard to argue in the wake of Roberts and Alito. You know, they didn't go at her and say, you need to come here and tell us more about your constitutional scholarship in advance of the hearings. Their line before the hearings was, you don't have judicial experience, which is basically you have a bad resume, and therefore that's not enough for me.
Because
support you.
They figured that's what they could go after her on. And now, you know, we've got,
but
I think.
But that is idiotic, because when you clerk for Supreme Court justice and you're the Solicitor General, which has always been seen as the 10th justice stepping stone to the court, that is as dead perfect a resume as you could possibly have. It doesn't fly that she doesn't have the proper experience.
Well, instead, we are left with legislators asking her about, you know, fruits and vegetable mandates, which I actually think was, at least from some of the libertarians I talked to, probably the exchange. I know it was sort of ridiculed on the left, but I think that was the exchange that people found the most interesting, at least from the circles that I read. Was the one that I saw noted most. My colleague Jacob Solom wrote a post sort of looking at how she basically refused to answer this question, and some of the jurisprudence going back, you know, with the Commerce Clause and what the limits are of it, which will be a big deal once, you know, at the point, I think we can assume that some point here, you know, the healthcare law will go to the Supreme Court, and she's going to have to make a decision based on maybe not whether or not the government can require people to purchase, to eat fruits and vegetables, but whether people are going to have to purchase health insurance. That's now what we're reduced to in terms of substantive questions, because you can't ask the actual question, because that's just going to get, no, I'm not going to talk about that because that might come up. So you have to ask these metaphorical sort of sideways whatever things that ended up making you sound pretty silly.
I mean, I wouldn't say that's the standard now. I think that's the standard that's been set for a few decades now.
Right.
It's only when the public is going to say, I want to hear more about a Supreme Court nominee's views before I want my senator to approve them, that's going to change. And most people don't want to hear that much. So most people are happy taking the president's word on the subject, barring something totally outlandish arising.
I don't know if I would agree with that, but I would say that the problem is that most people are sort of grumblingly satisfied with this approach, but that if you had what nominee would be acceptable if we actually found out what all of them really believe. If you got to that point, then you would divide, you would end up potentially dividing the electorate, I think, enough that you would have, it would be almost impossible to find somebody who could get through, because everybody would have something that was objectionable to a couple of subsets of people. So it would in the end be very difficult to find somebody who could get through, a process like that.
I think that's true.
More difficult than finding these vanilla people who don't have anything on their record.
Right. Well, on that note, let's shift to the other, I don't know if this was a topic that got a lot of attention this week, but it's definitely a simmering topic that's probably going to become a bigger and bigger issue down the line. The White House Debt Commission met the first meeting that they've had that's been live streamed that you actually could have watched. I don't think it got a lot of attention on the TV news. But if you wanted to log into whitehouse.gov, you could have watched. It was mostly other people coming in testifying to the commission. We didn't hear too much about what the commissioners themselves think, a little bit. The thing that got the most attention was the CBO director came in with a couple 75-year budget projections. And what was your take on that presentation?
Well, I thought there were a couple of interesting things going on there. The first, if you look at the presentation and you look at the long-term budget report that was released in conjunction, you have this kind of subtle coming out of Elmendorf. CBO Director Doug Elmendorf as being a mild healthcare skeptic. He's basically said that... let's see. He said a couple of things. One of the things he said was that the 2010 healthcare overhaul did not substantially diminish the challenge of cost cutting of the healthcare costs in the long term. And what that to me, that's at least a significant deflation, if maybe not quite a refutation, of the Peter Orszag argument that went around. You know, that was really big at the start of health reform and beforehand. That healthcare reform is entitlement reform. Well, we've done healthcare reform, and Elmendorf is now saying that no, even if things go as well as you expect them to, that's not diminishing the challenge in any significant way. And so I think for the Orszag view, that's going to hurt. And the second thing was that if you look at the alternative fiscal scenario that is included in this long-term budget report, maybe I should back up here. When the CBO puts out their long-term budget reports, they typically include two scenarios. One is called the extended baseline scenario. And under this scenario, we assume that current law doesn't change and that it is enacted exactly as written. So, for example, the Bush tax cuts expire. The doctors medical providers get a 21% pay cut for Medicare reimbursements. Things like that. Everybody knows that that's not really going to happen. The doctors are not going to get a big pay cut like that.
I wouldn't say everybody knows.
It is widely assumed that this is not going to happen, and the Bush tax cuts will probably not expire, at least not fully. And so then the CBO also puts out what's called the alternative fiscal scenario, in which the Bush tax cuts don't expire, and in which the doctor payments don't get cut, but in fact rise just slightly as they have been since 2003. And what they added this time was that from 2020 on, a lot of the cost controls, the mechanisms that were intending to restrain spending growth, particularly in Medicare, the CBO is now assuming that they won't work post 2020. And so this tracks with actually a lot of the skepticism of the healthcare bill that said, sure, maybe this could work, but it's not going to because of a variety of political factors. And so Kevin Drum has argued somewhat understandably, but I think too strongly, that the CBO has politicized itself, politicized its report by including this in the alternative fiscal scenario. But I think it's telling, no matter what, that you got the CBO director at least implicitly coming out and expressing some skepticism that the cost controls, that the mechanisms intended to restrain long-term spending growth probably aren't going to work. And to me, that was the big news that was in it, beyond the sort of the long-term deficit and debt projections.
Well, I don't know if it's news in that I think it was always clear that the CBO was skeptical about the cost controls. It still came out as a deficit reducer. I mean, he wasn't refuting the CBO's own numbers in that respect, but he wasn't predicting massive savings in the healthcare reform. Just the fact that you got any savings at all after expanding coverage to that degree was impressive on its own accord. But there's always been a dispute that CBO was lowballing the potential cost savings from these new cost control ideas. Igor Volsky revisited this in the wake of this new report. Quote, the problem is that CBO doesn't score things like prevention and payment reform and relies on narrow spectrum of evidence to estimate the cost and savings. This kind of math has gotten the agency in trouble before. For instance, the CBO consistently underestimated the savings from Medicare hospital payments in the early 1980s, which ended up saving more in just 1 year than CBO predicted for 3 years. So, you know, it's a debate how well health reform as it stands will work going forward. I think even the most optimistic analysts would say no one knows exactly how well this stuff is going to work. There's a lot of experimentation in these cost controls, and we'll likely have to revisit the issue over time to make sure that we get it right. And that's not an unusual approach to governing. And so I think Max Baucus, as Mark Amberger and HuffPost Hill quoted after this exchange at the commission, he was definitely took umbrage that the CBO director was sort of saying, there's no way you guys are going to do anything, or that's a likely option. When, from Baucus' standpoint, they already did something and would likely do more going forward. But it certainly, I'll just leave it at that point. I do think that obviously this gives fodder to conservatives to say, you guys are spinning your wheels on debt reduction. But I don't think the CBO's declaration is, you know, the definitive declaration on the subject.
Certainly not. And actually, this is something that I think cuts both ways. On when it comes to the CBO, a lot of people like to, this is something that always irritates me, is people like to say, well, the CBO said it will cut the deficit, and then we get, this bill will cut the deficit. It will cost this much. If the CBO says it will raise the deficit, people say that, by this much, whatever it is. And what the CBO never says is it will. They said this is our best guess. And the CBO has a bunch of very smart people. They do great work.
No one can be certain about these things.
But 10 years, you know, I mean, like, predicting what the economic effects of legislation would be 10 years or, Lord knows, 75 years into the future is impossible. And so you can take any of this with a grain of salt. And I think it actually the debate about the CBO would be and fiscal policy and the cost of legislation would be a lot healthier if both sides recognized the limits of our knowledge a lot more. The CBO does as good a job as they can possibly do at warning people that they only know so much and that there are limits to their projections. And you find these caveats, you know, at the end of nearly every report they put out. But inevitably it gets translated into this will cost this and it will reduce the deficit this much, or this will cost this much and it will raise the deficit by Lord knows this much, you know. And so, you know, and whereas the truth is that we really don't know, and that the CBO does as good a job as you can expect them to do, but there's still, you know, there's a huge amount of uncertainty built into this, just inherently. As a smart person once said, predictions are hard, especially about the future.
Well, I am in whole heart agreement with you. It would be wonderful if you looked at the CBO as helpful advice and not definitive gospel. And I also think that people should not be cherry-picking CBO and picking the numbers they like and ignore the numbers that they don't like. I've yet to find a conservative cite the CBO numbers on cap and trade, whereas they did on certain versions of the healthcare reform. But I think all CBO numbers should always be taken with a grain of salt, and that's all I got to say about that. Anything else to add, or should we move on to other blogosphere controversies?
Well, I think we've got plenty to talk about there.
So, you know, two big, you know, blog-only kerfuffles this week. So Daily Kos, the biggest liberal blog site out there, has filed suit against its former pollster, Research 2000. You know, there's definitely been a trend among some of the upper echelon blogs to do their own polling and try to make news that way, and try to poll things that poll races, poll issues, ask questions that bigger media operations aren't doing. Kos went as far as to have a weekly tracking poll, and a group of I'm not sure if they're professional statisticians or amateur statisticians, but they put together a paper and showed to Kos that they felt the research 2000 numbers were cooked, that there were stuff in the internals that didn't make any sense, and potentially you were buying fraudulent data. And so Coase severed his relationship with Research 2000 and filed suit. I believe Research 2000 is at least considering a countersuit, and this is roiling a lot of other media outlets, because, you know, Research 2000 has been around for a while. Plenty of other regular media outlets had used them. Whether or not they are putting too much blind faith in the polling that they get, you had Chuck Todd over at MSNBC blogging, and here's someone who's expressed skepticism about a lot of state polling before. He said, despite the merits of the suit, the story is a reminder how little confidence we have in many state polls, how problematic that makes it in trying to get a handle on individual midterm races. Some of the state polling we see are robo-polls conducted by an automated voice rather than a live person, which NBC doesn't report as policy. Here's a little secret. Good polls are expensive to do, and if you're seeing a particular organization doing a slew of polls, you've got to ask, one, how reliable are those numbers, or two, where is the money coming from to conduct those polls? Nowadays, on the state level, we trust polling we're getting from the campaigns and state parties, not necessarily those polls that are made public, more than the numbers we see from non-political polling organizations, and that's a clear shot across the bow, I think, to Rasmussen and to public policy polling. I believe public policy polling had a rebuttal to Chuck Todd saying, he's behind the times, you can do automated polling, and it's less expensive and it's still good. You know, don't lump us in with Research 2000, we don't know what's up with those guys. But you had other bloggers like Nate Silver at 538 and Mark Blumenthal at pollster.com also lend their skepticism to the Research 2000 numbers, and a whole Politico story saying that campaigns are all thrown for a loop because this is coming off the heels of the Arkansas primary, where Research 2000 showed Bill Halter having a lead and that not being the case in the end. And that drove a lot of media narrative for a few days based on that one single state poll. So I don't know if you have any additional thoughts on that.
Well, one of the things I really liked Greg Sargent's report on the lawsuit. I found this very instructive at the Plumline, and you know he points out some of the suspicious behavior that that Research 2000 has been involved in, and it's the kind of stuff it reminds me a lot of what you heard about Stephen Glass. You know, the business
plagiarist
about
that.
Right, the famous New Republic plagiarist, you know, and so you know, they keep acting like they're going to be really helpful throughout this process in which Daily Coast is investigating. Before this report was released, he let them know that, look, we've had some questions about your data, about your polling results. Can we see your data? And they promised, oh, yeah, sure, we'll just send it right over, no problem. Well, 2 weeks later, Coase still didn't have it. And they kept delaying and kept delaying and kept promising, you know, at one point saying, oh, our computers are down and we're having to say, you know, we can only send stuff from Kinko's. And, you know, it's some really bizarre behavior. And now they're sending cease and desist letters to Nate Silver for talking about this. I guess one of the questions that I have is, how does one get into, if presuming these polls are fake, are just totally made up, how does one get into the fake polling business? So this is what you have to ask. As you pointed out, there's sort of spillover effects from all the other polls they've conducted. Have any of them ever been real? And if you look at one of the Silver posts that he puts up, he estimated that they would probably be doing in the neighborhood of $600,000 a year in business with a call center in order to conduct these polls. So if they, you know, and presumably then they're charging more for that. So, but it's, and you make a lot more money if you're not actually conducting those polls and not actually paying the call center. So, you know, you just sort of wonder how many of these polls have been total junk. And what they were doing, you know, were they actually just filling in every little Excel spreadsheet themselves, you know, to create the false records here, you know, sort of, and how did this start? It's a very bizarre sort of thing. But on the other hand, you have the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which has used their polls, saying something to the, saying basically we think their polls are fine. They've always matched other polling companies that we've seen relatively well, and we don't have any problem with this. Maybe that's the Post-Dispatch doesn't want to get involved too much, but it, you know, it is interesting that their polls have at least when they're when other polls exist, their polls have matched them, and when, so when you can check, they're not so far off as to just be insane as to see, you know, and so. I guess I just sort of wonder what it is that they've been doing all this time, and you know whether any of their polls, because it seems to me that this is very, very fishy behavior, and that it's highly likely that a lot of their polls for Coase and for others were just totally made up out of whole cloth.
The issue is so much. I mean, I think their top line numbers may not have been wildly off. Even the Halter number wasn't, you know, a crazy number. It was probably within or close to the margin of error. It was a close race. But if you read what some of the analysis that's been done from these statisticians that helped out Coase, from Nate at 538, from Mark Blumenthal, issues in the internals that seem not to add up. So less so much of the top line number. I'm certainly not a statistician. I haven't seen so much beyond that St. Louis Post-Dispatch any real defensive research 2000. I'm certainly happy for this to be litigated and determined that way. But I think it does raise the question, you know, how do you get into the junk polling business? I think at this stage of the game, anyone can put out a polling number, and traditional media sites and blog sites and Twitter are just going to jump on it and drive it, and no one really cares. You know, no one stops to take a breath to say, does this poll make any sense or not? If you can gin up a headline out of it, it almost doesn't matter. And you can't prove whether an individual poll number is ever right or wrong at the end of the day, because obviously news events happen and things change, and no one expects a poll one month out for an election day to match what's going to happen at the on election day itself. So it's just very easy to get in the junk polling business unless there's going to be some. I mean, there is a polling association that has credentials,
right.
But unless you're going to say only people who in that group have their polls reported. And we're going to ignore everyone else's, you're never going to be able to enforce standards, because right now anyone can pick up a poll number, whether or not they have credentials or not, and it's going to get circulation.
Right. The as I understand, the Polling Association has asked Research 2000 to release its data, and Nate Silver noted this, and said, you know, made the point that the longer it takes for them to release their data, the more suspicious it is, and that, you know, they could solve this problem by releasing their data right now. As far as I know, unless something's changed within the last couple of hours, they haven't yet. And that, to me, despite the fact that they are still they still claim that they are going to be vindicated in the end, the fact that they have yet to release their data, which would be the easy thing to do, they have to have this data if they've done the polls. It suggests to me that they are definitely trying to hide something. On the other hand, there is, you know, I mean, there's the legal reasons, maybe not to at this point since they're being sued. But I think, you know, to go back to what maybe conservatives are thinking about this, you know, I think conservatives, for one thing, are actually pretty impressed with Marcos Melitzas for coming clean like this. Not that I would have expected otherwise, but still, it's a really hard thing to do. To come and say, I've been totally taken, and we published a year and a half's worth of polls that were bunk, as he says. The letter that he put out and the investigation was, I think, in many ways a model of how to do self-reporting and self-investigation. And a lot of publications, you know, not that I think that there's a lot of this sort of thing going on, at least I hope not, but for publications who face this sort of thing or something like it in the future, I think looking at this as an example is a good thing. And Marcos Melitzas really has acquitted himself very well in the way he's handled this.
The other big blogosphere, or should I say, it's not quite blog, but online media story, is the fallout from the Dave Weigel resignation, although he was picked up by MSNBC. This week, so he's certainly not missing a paycheck. But outside of what's up with Dave's career, there's this issue about off-the-record private listservs being used in traditional media circles, online media circles, blog circles, political circles. You have Andrew Breitbart, the conservative mogul behind the big government collection of websites, offering a bounty of $100,000 for the entire archive of the Journal List that Dave Weigel was on, that Ezra Klein ran, but he put the kill switch on after this whole incident. And Andrew Sullivan attacking Breitbart for unethical behavior and trying to essentially ask someone to steal something that is not theirs and hand it over to Breitbart. And you have a separate issue with a conservative listserv that is affiliated. I'm not sure if it's officially affiliated with the RNC or the RNC is on it, but other bloggers are on it too. There was a spat there that Dan Reel at Reel Worldview broke the code on it being a private listserv and released an email because he thought that the behavior from the person from the RNC was so abhorrent. That led Ezra Klein to say, sort of make a distinction between his Journal List, which did not have any political figures on it, and this one that had direct cut ties to the RNC. Dan Reel then responding, this was a technical site. This is not about a discussion of issues. This is about trading information about, ways to do things online in a technical fashion. Therefore, it's not the same deal as a bunch of liberal pundits conspiring to voice their views on an unsuspecting public. There's a lot there. I don't know what the general buzz on the conservative side is on the ethics of all this. Should there be these listservs at all? Or in Ezra's phrasing, this is just a normal way for people to communicate in the modern era.
Well, I think there has definitely been a lot of fascination with journalists from the right, broadly speaking, this because of the prominence of some of the members, and the fact that a lot of that in addition to avowedly liberal reporter, blogger, pundit types, there were also folks who were more straight reporters who were on the list. And so that, I think, always irked a lot of people on the right. And so that has made the list, and the fact that there may or may not be controversial stuff being said on the list, that's made it an object of attention and discussion. And so that's, I think, the right is, sort of maybe it's somewhat understandably curious about what was said. Now, my guess is I know some people who are on the list. I certainly don't know. I've never seen anything on the list. I don't know most of the people on the list. I'm guessing I don't know who most of the members were. But when something is said behind closed doors, especially when it's being said by people who are, say, on the other side of a political issue, you're sort of on the other team, you wonder what it is, and it's kind of natural. And when some of the stuff like this comes out that shows that there are some things being said that are potentially controversial, that curiosity is going to increase. And I think that's what's at play in the Breitbart, in Breitbart's offer. I do wonder whether Breitbart is going to be able to get the whole archive, if he can get it, because most people, when the list started, I don't know how many people were on it, but it wasn't the several hundred that ended up on it. So most people have not been on the list since its inception. And I also wonder if he would know, if he would be able to tell if it had been edited, if threads or comments or particular emails had been deleted. Now, Gmail archives everything, and a lot of people use Gmail, but it is possible to delete things out of Gmail, and I just wonder if it would be possible to sort of to sell Breitbart a list that had been, selectively edited and take out any really damning stuff, I don't know if there even is any particularly damning stuff.
I'm guessing Breitbart is not really expecting to get his hands on the list. I assume
I think he might be. I'll just say I think he might be expecting. We'll see if it comes out or not. I have no idea. Certainly it hasn't happened yet. There's nobody who's sold it at this point.
It's an opportunity just to raise this notion of there being a secret cabal of liberal journalists that are utterly biased and you can't trust anything that they say, and you can only trust conservative websites to get to the real news.
Well, you know, there's the opportunity to say that, except that the fact that everybody uses listservs to communicate, to talk about, to find out what's going on, to get access to the hive mind, and I don't mean access in a conspiratorial way or in a coordinating way necessarily, but it's so much easier when in Washington you have so many of these small communities of people who write about the same things from something like the same perspective or from perspectives where there's a lot of overlap. And so naturally you want to talk to each other all the time. Well, in the end, it usually just becomes easier to just put everybody on a listserv and send everything to everybody. And my guess is, my understanding is that that's how journalists started, is Ezra, Joe Klein, some of the other folks who were on that list wanted to talk amongst themselves about some of these issues. They didn't want it to be on the record, understandably, because if you want to talk freely, and not worry about it, it's always easier to do if it's off the record and people can't and it can't be repeated elsewhere. As Ezra said in his note, it was about preventing the idea, keeping the idea of point scoring out of it. You just want to get to the heart of the issue rather than score points. And people on the right do this too. I'm on any number of listservs. I don't even know whether they're supposed to be secret or not because it's never been discussed. It's just like, oh, we all want to talk to each other. I'm on a listserv with, all the people I went to college with. It's an easy way to communicate with a large group of people who are interested in the same things. And it doesn't strike me as particularly conspiratorial. Whether there was coordination or whether there was anything, that's going to cause people problems on that list, I have no idea. We'll find out. I totally understand the fascination that Breitbart has, that some of the other right-wing sites have with this list, because when that many people who are relatively prominent on the other side are talking to each other and not letting you hear what they're saying, you're going to start to wonder, at least, and be curious. And and even to develop conspiracy theories, conspiracy theories come when there's an information gap. When you don't have information, people start to fill in the information. And that's how conspiracy theories develop. And you see this in countries that have the worst news, the least reliable state-run news that, just only gives you propaganda and where there's a lot of censorship. Those are the countries where there's a lot of conspiracy theories, spread out even through the upper echelons of society. It's because they don't have access to real information. And so the human mind, what you do naturally is to wonder about what's going on and to invent some story.
And the curiosity is totally understandable, but just from a straight ethical standpoint, what's the difference of communicating to folks like this privately through online means than going to the National Press Club or going to a cocktail party at the editor of the Washington Post house or going to a poker game run by a Supreme Court justice? I mean, everyone in Washington is going to have some sort of interaction with other people. Right. That you're not going to be privy to. There's not a sunshine meeting law for all of journalism that everyone gets to have a C-SPAN camera perched on their shoulder, everything they're going to say every minute of the day. It's impossible. I don't know how you prevent that from happening.
Well, I don't think you prevent it, but I think what you have to do is distinguish the practices from the medium. In the same way that there's nothing wrong with everybody with a whole bunch of like-minded folks on whatever side of the political aisle meeting at somebody's house and discussing the issues they all write about and care about. But there would be something wrong if a whole bunch of people who did this met and coordinated coverage, made intentional decisions we're going to sort of across publications, across think tank, whatever it is. I would, at least be a little worried if people were deciding to do some of that.
We know that people already leak from this list to screw other people. No right. One's ever leaked anything that remotely indicated anything like coordination.
Right. So, like I said, I'm not saying there's coordination. I have no idea what's on the list except what's been leaked, and been written about everywhere. If there's a legitimate worry about the ethics, it's not about the the medium, the format, the place that the people are meeting. People meet, and they, as you say, then they have contact with each other, and you're not going to get to know about it. You're totally right. On the other hand, it does depend on what they do when they meet and what they plan, if anything. I don't know. Like I said, I have no idea if what, whatever, what was most, my guess is most of what was said on the list is entirely innocuous and wouldn't, you know, is just the sort of stuff that you, that you wouldn't be surprised to see on a blog, perhaps a little rougher, a little more casual, as emails tend to be. If you're going to worry about it, if you're going to worry about the ethical violations, I would say that it's how the list is used and what people discuss, and then the, in particular any actions they take as a result that could be potentially worrisome. And that's the distinction you have to make. Is not that it's there's some inherent problem with a listserv, just there's no inherent problem with a house meeting, but there might be a problem if people at different publications decided to coordinate or whatever. And if that's what conservatives think or thinks going on, like I said, I have no idea one way or another, then that is the legitimate worry.
This has been a solid hour of scintillating conversation, so perhaps we should end it on that note, Peter.
Very nice talking to you, sir.
Always great talking to you. I'm glad you could do another spin with us.
Glad to be here.
Have you back soon.
Thank you so much. Happy to come back anytime.
Next week. I think next week we'll be back with Matt Lewis and myself. And don't hold your breath. Go about your daily lives, and we'll talk to you next week. Take care.